The trouble with this gospel thing is that once you start spending time in it, studying it, listening to it, walking around in it, you'll find that it's everywhere. This truth that has been hidden since the foundation of the world. For me this week, it happened actually while I was reading the comics. You know, the funny papers? You know that thing called a newspaper? Yeah, that. And one of the comic strips that I really enjoy, it's called The Nightlife, Night with a K, and it has these three panels. In the first panel, a police officer was talking to the driver of a car that he'd apparently just pulled over. The police officer says, "You're probably wondering why I stopped you. I have a woman who claims to be your wife in the back of my vehicle." In the next panel, the driver of the car says, "Really? What'd she do?" The police officer says, "Punched a Nazi." And the driver of the car then responds, "That's my baby." Punch a Nazi, that's actually a thing. It's got its own hashtag, you know, hashtag punch a Nazi. There's now an app that you can download to your mobile device. And it all stems from the inauguration of our new president on January 20th, when Richard Spencer, who is a prominent white nationalist, believes that at the least we should have a state only of white people. When he's also the person apparently that has coined the term alt-right. He was giving an interview to an Australian broadcast team, and during the television interview, someone walked up and punched him in the face. Not surprisingly, it went viral. Because, well, why? Because there's a part of us that gets fed when someone is given their just desserts and when it's hand-delivered. And there are some of us who say that, well, this is further evidence, it's proof that force is inevitable. And because it made people consider. What do you do? What do you do when hate-filled, deeds, when, what do you, when, what do you do when they happen so that you stop them from being accepted, normative behavior? What do you do when you are confronted with someone who represents what you hate? The last time that John McGraw and Rakeem Jones had seen one another, John McGraw had just thrown an elbow into the face of Rakeem Jones. It was at a Donald Trump rally in Fayetteville, North Carolina. You may have either seen that video or have read this story that was first reported in the Washington Post. About a year ago, during one of Donald Trump's rallies, Rakeem Jones was there to protest. And he was yelling at Donald Trump and others. And as he was being escorted away, he was walking down the aisle. And 79-year-old white man Richard McGraw stood up and threw an elbow into the face of 27-year-old black man Rakeem Jones. Rakeem Jones was knocked to the ground, was then pulled up by the sheriff's deputies and escorted from the rally. The next day, John McGraw was arrested on charges of assault and battery and of disorderly conduct. This incident, captured on a cell phone video, was viral. It made national news because I think it was as if in one moment, all these currents and subcurrents that are coursing through our country were brought into sharp focus. Race, power, public discourse, mob mentality, violence, conflict. And again, it begged questions. Questions like, what does it mean to dissent? What does it mean to go to a rally and rage against the machine? When you come to realize that the world around you does not reflect what you believe to be holy and true, what do you do? When you come face to face with your enemy, how do you respond? René Girard was a 20th century historian and theologian. And as part of his groundbreaking work on desire and violence and scapegoating, retribution, he wrote that much of the world's violence is perpetuated in a mimetic way. That is, we mime or mirror or reflect back and forth the same practices that have been visited upon us by others. And this can be just as true for large groups and institutions, governments, nations, as it is for individuals. By returning the violence that we have received, we feel that we have protected ourselves, right? We have ensured our own safety by inflicting pain upon the other, sometimes any other. Now, this behavior actually happens anywhere that human beings gather. It happens between prison guards and prisoners. It happens between baseball teams. It happens within couples. I return the aggression that you have inflicted upon me, which you will likely repeat, and so will I, and on it goes, unless someone breaks the cycle. Does this sound familiar? It is, in fact, just what we have heard, that ancient maxim, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And then this morning, Jesus, evoking centuries of Jewish thought, Jesus says, instead, love your neighbor. And not just your kin, not just your friends, not just your people, but love your enemy. Pray for the one who persecutes you. Now, I feel compelled to spend some time here exploring what Jesus might have meant about love, right? Because I think it's important to talk about what it is and what it is not. A few weeks ago in the Beatitudes, Jesus was giving us a vision of that realm of heaven, which is in the here and now. And today in this passage, he's filling in some of the details. And for me and for many others, for these details, it was the scholar and theologian Walter Wink who unlocked this power of this love of Jesus. You may remember that some of this was part of what I preached several years ago on this very text, but I believe it bears consideration again for us today because the context of Jesus' examples are essential to its understanding as he presents this third way that is neither flight because of fear or fight through force. So I'd like to volunteer. Liz, why don't you come on up? So what you'll notice in this text is that Jesus says, if someone is to strike you on the right cheek, that's really important. Because in this culture, if you were to strike someone, and if you were to strike them with a closed fist or with an open hand, you were treating them as an equal, right? This was you saying, okay, we are on the same playing field, so to speak. But if you wanted to maintain your superiority and remind someone that they were inferior to you, what you would do is you would strike them with the back of your hand. Now, in this culture, you can't use your left hand. It is unclean. And so if you're to strike someone with the back of your hand, it looks like this. That was just my nose. Try again. Yeah, that was solid. So she did so with her the back of her hand, right? Now, if I turn my other cheek, she cannot use her left hand. It is unclean. If she's going to strike me, and I invite her to strike me, she's going to do so with her open palm, right? Thereby acknowledging that we are equals. I am doing this not because the abused deserves any more punishment from the abuser, but in fact to stand my ground and say, if you are going to hit me, you will treat me as your fellow human, as your equal. Thank you. The same is true for the second mile, right? In the Roman Empire, the Roman soldier could commandeer any civilian to carry their equipment for 1 mile. This was not just logistically helpful. It was a not so subtle way for the empire to say, remember who's in charge here. So, if you were to come to the end of that forced mile and say to that Roman soldier, I will carry this another mile, you are saying to that soldier and to everybody else around, I am going to expose this system, this unjust system, for what it is and for your participation in it. I am willing to go another mile to do this and to show you what you are a part of and possibly recover you in the process. Now, these are just a couple shining examples from this day and time about what Jesus means when he talks about love your enemies. It's a third way, right? It's not the flight of fear. It's not the fight with force. But it's a remaining with intent, an intent to show all those around us what is taking place, so that we will wake up and demand that it change. And in the process, we may even win over our aggressor. It was for this reason that Gandhi drew from this gospel and this chapter and these verses as he was setting up his campaign for nonviolent resistance of the British Empire in India. And it was this gospel and this chapter and these verses that thousands and thousands of African Americans and their allies engaged in the movement for civil rights in this country. Now, life, of course, continues even when all the cameras have been packed up and moved on to the next ring of the 12-ring circus of this past year. Now, for Rakim Jones, what that meant is trying just to make it. Rakim lives in a mobile home park on the outside of Fayetteville, and he had to quit his job because of the publicity that his company received as a result of the incidents at the Trump rally. And so he's been making ends meet by working a pizza delivery job. And every week, as it got closer and closer to the trial of John McGraw, Rakeem Jones found himself getting more and more apprehensive. As for John McGraw, he also lives in a trailer park on the outside of Fayetteville. He barely makes it on his Social Security payments. He makes his ends meet by making leather belts and leather gun holsters. And he himself felt dread as the date of this trial was approaching because he just could not believe what was happening in his country, that it no longer held the decency that he stood for. And he could not believe that he had participated with his own indecency. The trial was in its final portion. The courtroom had quite a few people in it, and in front of those gathered, Rakeem Jones spoke. And John McGraw, well, his attorney spoke and wanted to make sure that everyone knew that Mr. McGraw's actions were not racially motivated. Now, this spurred Rakeem Jones to say this: "Not one time throughout the whole 6 months have I mentioned race. I got hit by a man, period." The judge then asked John McGraw directly if he had something to say. He told the judge, "I am extremely sorry this happened." The judge, in a very wise move, said, "Don't say it to me. Say it to him." And so John McGraw turned to Rakeem Jones. It's the first time they'd seen each other directly since the rally. And John McGraw took a step towards him. And he said, "This was between two men. You know what you did, and I know what I did. I'm not going to say you were wrong or I was wrong." And then he took another step. He held up his finger, and the people in the room said that this is when his jaw began to tremble. And he said, "You and me, we got to heal our country." There was a moment of silence. And then Rakeem Jones replied, "All right, man." And he reached out to pat John McGraw on the shoulder, and John McGraw was surprised by it, but then actually reached out his hand. And as Rakeem Jones grasped John McGraw's hand, applause began to build in the courtroom, and the two men then embraced. Now, this one moment does not solve the multiplicity of conflict and ugliness, uncertainty that we face as a nation. But it can serve as a guiding light. Because Rakeem Jones could have chosen to continue the cycle. He well would have been in his rights. In fact, there are those who, in the days after the trial, they called him a sellout. Right? He returned to his trailer that day to messages on his machine and on his phone, and you know, some thought he was weak for forgiving John McGraw, wrong for shaking his hand, wrong for hugging him. In his words, though, Rakeem Jones, after the rally and after the election, he felt like it was time for him to let it go. So when John McGraw called him the next day, Rakeem Jones listened to what he had to say and told him that he appreciated the call. Then, as now, there are many who say that this way of being is misguided at best or simply hopelessly naive, and that violence is the only answer to beat back the aggressor, the only way to protect the weak and the vulnerable. Perhaps that's true for a while. But violent retaliation leaves little chance that it will end there, and little chance for that other person to be redeemed. This means that our tactics, our means, matter. We can't actually choose any means necessary, because the means that we choose inevitably, necessarily point to an end. For us, the question remains, what end are you and I willing to point to? It's why the last verse of our gospel passage is our way home. Often we get caught in one particular word of that last verse. For me, that word is perfect. Right now, I know, and you may know from firsthand experience, that only God is perfect. So what's the deal? Well, the deal here is actually in the Greek, because the word for perfect is teleos, right? That root of telos, which is an end point. It is the goal. It is the fullness. It is the completion. It is the fulfillment. What Jesus is saying is to bring to completion our world, ourselves, as God is complete. That is the goal. Our eyes on the prize for those who would live in the realm of heaven. It is the completeness of being and of being. So it seems to me that this is where our radical Jesus is pointing us towards. Loving our enemy makes us complete. I'll say it again, because Lord, even as I believe it, help me in my unbelief. Loving our enemies makes us complete.